Welcome to the podcast, Corey Close, the head coach at UCLA. Coach Close has her team number 3 in the country, number 2 in the net at 15-1 at the time of this taping, and just running through the Big Ten right now. Coach, thanks for being with us.
No, I'm excited to be with y'all. So it makes me nervous when you start talking about that. We're not running through anything. We're just getting started, Dantonelli. Let's go.
Listen, your team is so balanced. You have multiple ways to win. You have multiple ways to defend teams, multiple ways to score. I don't see a deficiency. I think your schedule has been so challenging. You're going to be ready. You are ready.
Well, and I think that's exactly why we scheduled the way we did, right? We knew we were going to have a veteran group, and we wanted to be challenged in as many different ways as we possibly could. You know, you got to build those reference points, even when you fail. Like, I can't, you know, Texas, we failed, Aaron, but that also was such a good teaching point. So I think as long as you can keep, you have the maturity to keep that in check and know that failure can be, if you're willing to, can be just feedback that really helps you go to another level. And so far, we've been able to do that.
Failure, adversity, challenges, all the things that every team faces. You're going to face it at some point. It doesn't matter when you face it, but it could matter when you face it. But you want to face it early so that you can fix it. You've always been a solutions-based leader, thinker, doer. When you put your team in situations in practice, because I know that's probably what you're doing all the time, is working on certain situations, time and score and all that. What are some of the principal things that you're thinking about, Corey, and making sure that you're ready?
Well, I think it's, you know, really, it's our entire staff. And actually, I've designated a staff member that I expect to be an expert on special situations. And so we spend 15 minutes a day in every single practice, whether it be earlier in the year. I didn't think we were finishing out quarters as well as we needed to. And so really figuring out, okay, what fits our team in order to get the last shot. And I didn't think we were executing that as well. So it could be, you know, 2-for-1s, you know, whether it be a last second play, things that maybe you're not showing all the time, but you're working on it all the time. So you're prepared. And we literally go through a checklist at the beginning of the year. And everybody brings things they've maybe been studying or finding, or an NBA play they watched, or a WNBA play, or, you know, and then we go situation by situation, and then we come up with our three best plays. And then every couple of weeks, we sort of do a check-in on how we're doing with that. But Tony Noonan is, he is in charge. And in the last 2 minutes of a game, I'll pretty much do all the things leading up to that. But he knows he better be ready. And we always, you know, sort of check in those scenarios, like, hey, what do you think? We're down 3, we're going to advance the ball here. What do you think? This or this? But I put him in charge for a reason, and I hold him responsible and accountable to be ready for those things. But this is an everyday, all the time kind of thing that we're trying to always prepare for, especially when you're winning by a large margins. You don't get the in-game experience a lot in some of those. And so it's really important that it becomes a rhythm of what we practice every day.
So I'm thinking while you're speaking about situations, right? Most coaches are thinking situations, like you said, 2-for-1, out of bounds plays, ATOs, jump ball at the beginning. You're talking about the last 2 minutes, like having a coach designated for the last 2 minutes. I almost kind of think of it like football. You know, the head coach is down on the field with a headset, and you've got offensive and defensive coordinators, and you're checking in like that. You are making the ultimate decisions, but he's just prepping for the last 2 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I think you have to have people that are, you know, so I call them head coaches in their area, you know, and I want to have a lot of people that see themselves with the ownership and level of excellence that they know they're responsible. And I think your preparation goes to another level when everybody feels like, okay, this is my job and I have to be ready and I don't want to let anyone down in this area. So, you know, we've got different people in charge of different areas to that end. And they've really stepped up in great ways.
Okay. So let's talk some situations like 2-for-1, killing the clock, when to foul, when not to foul, things like that. Like, what? Break it down a little bit for us.
Well, I think part of it is interesting. You know, I think you do have to know your team. And I've had teams in the past that, you know, if you did an analytics breakdown, you probably always want to foul if you're up three, the other team has the ball. And from an analytics perspective, there's a lot more that has to go wrong for you to not win that situation if you foul. That being said, there was a few years ago where we worked on it and worked on it, and it just didn't fit our team.
Yeah.
The personality of our team, we weren't choosing the right time, the directions, all the decisions that needed to be made. We were a lot younger. I think you do have to have a pretty high basketball IQ to understand, you know, what direction are they going and all the things that go into that. And so we decided that year, you know what? I know what the analytics say, but for us, we're going to try to chase everybody off the line. We're going to try to be aggressive. Everyone's got to be willing to touch.
Yeah.
We're obviously not going to help. And so we chose that year to not foul in those scenarios. And so I do think there's an art form as well as a formula. And you have to sort of marry those by knowing your own team. Yeah. And so this year, we've been the opposite. You know, I have a very mature team. We're long. We can anticipate. And we work on it a lot more. So we've, for instance, fouled in those scenarios. You know, on the other hand, like, for instance, killing the clock in the last, you know, end of quarters or, you know, trying to get the last shot. I didn't like at the beginning of the year. We were just sort of dribbling it out, and then coming with a high ball screen, or we run a little bit of a flare on one side, you know, slot screen on the other. And, you know, we felt like the other team could be so anticipatory when we're just killing it until, you know, 11 seconds, 9, 8. And so we brought in some, we looked at other false actions. If we're in the like 20 to, you know, 18 to 25 area, like, okay, what's some action that's going to take that we can really take care of the ball, that we can create some false actions, some ball reversal, so that when we get to our attacking mode, we haven't had the defense just sitting there ready to anticipate and ready to, you know what they're going to do. And so I know that when I know a team, like, oh, a lot of teams now want to go to their ghost in the middle of the floor and try to get downhill off of that. Sometimes we'll go zone if it's happening in the last. Zone, or we switch certain things. Yeah. So we were when you switch it back over to the offense, I'm like, well, we need to have some false action and some ball reversal so people can't anticipate that to the same level. Yeah. So those are some things we've been breaking down with our team that I think are important.
And that saves you from having to burn a timeout also if you're working on those things. The other thing about killing the clock besides that part of it is, like, the other team scores, the ball goes through the net, there's 33, 34 seconds left. I see it on the men's side a lot. Like, the guys will take their time inbounding it so they make sure they do get the last possession of the quarter or the half. I think that's something that I'm starting to see a little bit more of, the IQ of really experienced players doing that as well. And you got a lot of IQ on your team, Corey.
Yeah, you know, and that's actually a really good point, to be honest with you. You know, we haven't worked on that as much. We have a little bit in terms of in-game scenarios, just making sure that we're in a situation where we got the right people where we want them to be, but the clock is stopped in the last minute. So it's a different situation. But, you know, I agree with you. That's something actually we should work on. And Debbie, we haven't been, if I'm being honest. And so good job. I'll be on that the next week.
Yeah. I'm always looking for something that I can use in broadcast too.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking it, and I know, I watch a lot of film. I certainly don't watch as much film as you do, but I do my due diligence on trying to be prepared to, you know, showcase the game at the highest level. And that includes the coaches.
No, and I appreciate that. I mean, you always have been a proponent of that. You're always trying to think about, you know, I know your W's of good point guard play. Yeah. I hear you on that. I know the different things that you do, but it does a lot to grow the game, is to have commentators who actually are trying to grow themselves and bring little nuggets into the broadcast. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for saying that. So you just lead me right into my next question, which is, you know, I do think you're a great thinker about the game. You're not just worried about UCLA. I think it's a really good trait that you carry, Corey, because of the roles that you've played in different committees with the WBCA or the NCAA, the Oversights Committee, all the things that have a leadership component to them. So I want to ask you a couple of questions about what you think about these things.
Okay.
All right. So the appeals versus the challenges vernacular between the men and the women. It can be confusing for the fan.
Yeah, I think it's way confusing. It's confusing for the coach. Forget the fan. I mean, you know, and even the players don't understand. I actually saw it last night in the Texas LSU game for the women. They were, you know, vehemently asking their coach to review something, but you can't review it in the women's side, and you actually can review it in the men's side. I think we got to evolve in this. I get it. I appreciate that we took a step this year in terms of being able to, you know, call for a, you know, review on the certain, you know, out of bounds and some things like that. But I sort of think it's a little bit, I don't know, it's almost like, and I don't think this was anyone's intention, but it's almost a little patronizing because it's like we couldn't handle anymore, you know, and I think our game is at a level that we can, you know, really attack some things in these situations. And I do think, though, I mean, we've benefited from this difference. But like, for instance, the men can't advance the ball. Like, they're like the only college men are the only ones that can't do that. And I think it's holding back their game. But I do think in general, in this case with the replay, I think we would be really wise to come together and think about what's really makes sense and to make our vocabulary the same, to make our, you know, sort of the language that we use, the rules be comparable. I do think that would be a really smart thing to do.
Yeah, we just got this year F1, F2 on the women's side, which every time there was an intentional or disqualifying foul, I had to clarify to the fan watching at home. And it just was confusing to him. So yeah. I don't have the data on this, but I've just got a really strong feeling that I never liked two free throws. I always liked the one and one. And I think free throw shooting has gotten worse since we went to two free throws.
Well, it's interesting. I have two schools of thought on this. One is I do like the consistency of across FIBA and the Olympics, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, they do play two shots. And so that being said, I like the consistency of that. On the other hand, I like the, what it rewards to have the one and one. I think the hard part is that, in the quarter system, it's harder to have the numbers. Whereas the men in the, you know, having just two halves, which I don't like as much, I don't think that's as good for the game. But it does give them more flexibility in creating a one-on-one situation leading to a two-shot situation. So I've sort of got some tug and pull on that, if I'm being really honest. But I think a greater question is, that's, I think, a good for the entertainment factor. More so than I'm like,
drama.
Hey, you want to blow the game? Make your free throws. Like, you know, work
drama.
On it.
Right.
Yeah. Strategy. I do like the drama of it, for sure.
I do,
that
too.
That piece is good. You know, I think that that's something the women, though, have done better than the men. And we have two shots and the men have one and ones. So, you know, maybe it's not that way.
I don't think scoring has increased significantly with two free throws. I actually am. I'd have to find somebody who can do a little study on that. OK. In football, you can play four games and not lose your eligibility.
Don't get me started on this one. Okay,
go ahead. This is a good one. Okay, this is a good one for you, Corey, because if we allowed whatever the number is, which is the declaration on a redshirt year, if it's 8 or 9 or whatever the percentage works out to be, why wouldn't we do the same thing? We have such a so much movement in our game, and it might be the difference between a young player realizing that, you know what, I got a lot to learn. I got a lot to work on the weight room. I'm playing behind a couple of players. Maybe if I just get it a little time here and there and then play in the non-conference, and then when conference play, shut it down, don't lose your eligibility. I don't know, something like that.
I could not agree more. I am so frustrated with our lack of congruency on this issue. Why we would pass that for football and not have strategy and planning for at least the basketballs, but other sports too, obviously that's the one I'm most tuned into, is beyond me. I just think, you know, and then you're offering 6 and 7 years to guys in football, you know, cause just because you came from a Division II. You know, or how about in basketball, you can play 2 years of junior college and then play 4 more years. But a kid who gets hurt in the second half of the season past the 50% rule can't redshirt, and they can't, like, it just makes no sense. And we're rewarding the wrong things. I actually, quite frankly, have an appeal, a waiver appeal with the NCAA right now in this particular issue.
No way.
Yeah, right now. And I haven't heard back yet. And I think that, you know, number one, they didn't do the fifth year of eligibility like they said they implied that they were going to, and they pushed it forward. They kicked the can. And then secondly, now we still don't have this 30% rule that it can happen at any point in the year. We still have a rule in basketball that it can't happen in the second half of the season. So pretty much anything after January 1, it doesn't matter if it's 30%. So I have a kid who hasn't played at all right now and you know, is going to be getting healthy, but it's on the second half. So now you're saying, well, she really can't play and be a part of this experience, even though it will be less than 30%.
Why would you want to use your eligibility if you only have, you're going to lose the year? And,
right.
And then you're going to try to fit into a rotation where, yeah.
Right. But she shouldn't have to make that choice, right? Because, you know.
And neither should you. You shouldn't have to make it either.
I agree. And if you're giving that option to play a bowl game as your fourth game in red shirt with football, it's no way that they shouldn't be giving that opportunity to women's or men's basketball players.
Okay, so I want to ask you about the net.
Okay. I'm not very knowledgeable, so.
Okay, but Who is? I mean, we don't really know. Every coach I talk to says they don't really know what's in the net.
Yeah.
But we have a net system. We have quads. And our quads are different than the men. And according to what I've been told, part of the reason why the numbers are different in the quads between the ones, twos, threes, and fours on the road and at home and neutral is because the women have shown a lesser propensity to have a home court advantage than the men. So they change the numbers. I don't know if that's something somebody told me. I'm not going to quote the person that gave that to me, but that's what I was given. So, so here we are. You are 7-1 in quad ones. Zero bad losses. Okay. In your league right now, as of today, at the taping of this, and you're getting ready, coming off the win over Nebraska, getting ready to play Minnesota. Right now, based on my math, which, you know, okay, you've got 6 more quad ones and 1 more quad two left on your schedule. That's a lot of quad opportunities because your league is so good.
Right.
You're going to be in the mix, obviously, for a one seed, and there's going to be a lot of conversation about who's the overall one, all that stuff. Does that matter to you? And does it resonate with you on a day-to-day basis? Are you following it? Where are you on the quads?
Well, I think, you know, obviously every time I'm asked that in media, I make sure everybody knows that we have more quad one wins than anybody else. You know, I'd be foolish not to. I'm definitely going to, you know, I think if the committee is going to say that strength of schedule is really important, then I'm going to make sure that they remember that our strength of schedule was number 2 in the country behind Southern in non-conference, plus playing the highest net ranking conference in the conference in the Big Ten. Yeah. So, you know, I do try to pound our chest, so to speak, about what we've done. On the other hand, I'm not the person that's going to spend my energy on something that's really out of my control. Do I wish that they would define what the net is? Yes. I mean, no one's willing to give up the true formula of what it is. And I'm like, why not? That's shady. I just don't think that's wise for our game. Let's have all of our cards out on the table and let's be transparent about what you're looking at. And otherwise, why would you put stock into something that you can't even trace how to get to it? So, I'm trying not to do that. We had the privilege of being the overall number one seed last year, and a number two seed won the national championship and was playing the best basketball. So at some point, I don't want to put my attention on something that keeps us from playing our best basketball. The bottom line is, if we've done all these things, then we should be prepared to play our best when our best is needed. And so I'm going to put much more of my attention into making sure we're playing well. You know, I think if I would like to be a number one seed, if I feel like we've earned it, but whether or not we're the overall number one, the next number two, you know, UConn, obviously is the defending national champions. They earned it. They played the best into it. They're not going to have the opportunity to get as many quad wins, one wins as we're going to because of their conference. And so I don't know. I don't get paid enough to figure that out too, but, you know, I think that's a hard situation. I just think that it's like splitting hairs at some point. So I'm just going to try to focus in on the things that are under my control and try to get our team to be playing the best basketball come March.
You're right. It's going to be splitting hairs. It's going to be a really interesting conversation when we get to that point, should everything hold as it is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure with UConn's schedule, with just Notre Dame and Tennessee remaining, if those are even going to be quad ones by the time they get to those. Notre Dame just had a really big win over North Carolina at home. Game that I called, Hannah Hidalgo was fantastic.
I listened to you, Debbie. Good job.
Carried them the whole way. I mean, it was just impressive, the whole thing that she did. So this year, by invitation only, the NCAA is bringing back the mock selection.
Oh, good. Okay.
I got an invite.
Okay.
They're going to let me in the building.
Good. I think that's amazing.
And ESPN's going to let me take the invitation. So
good.
There's going to be really interesting conversation. There's a lot of new, since the last mock invitations that they had, which was years ago, which I did attend a couple of those. There's a lot to learn in there. If you were sitting in there, what would be one or two things that you would want to know from the committee?
I think that it's just the authenticity between what's stated is most important and what is actually the deciding factors. And when you, and also when you have really telling the story of how it works when you have 9 ranked teams and 13 teams from the Big Ten, let's say that many get in, let's just say, how does that work in seed lines and when can they meet? I don't think the most fans understand that, let alone coaches, but I think it has to, I would want to know what in that room tells me how I need to schedule year in and year out to put our team in the best chance to get the best seed. And, you know, and I just don't think there's clarity there all the time. And so I want to know about that. And so, then I just, go ahead.
So I think there are 12 or 14 pieces of criteria that I think they use. The AP poll is not one of them. The net has really carried a little bit more weight.
Okay.
And for the Big Ten purposes, the net for you guys, I mean, you're in good shape, right? I mean, you could have more quad one wins than anybody when it gets to the end, which, like you said, you have more right now. My husband works in the golf industry, and he has worked in clubs where they had committees. And this is the best way I can describe the NCAA selection process. Like, if you have a chair of the clubhouse committee that likes chicken, then everything in the food and beverage is going to be catered to chicken dishes. But then the next year, the guy that comes in likes steak. So everything has to change on the, so every process and everything that you do, it sounds like it's a small thing, but it changes the whole ordering process of everything that you need to have a balanced meal and prepare a high level first class meal. 5 stars. Okay.
Yep.
That's what happens with the committee. We don't really know which metric is valued more than another. The committee chair changes. It's not their fault. I'm just stating it's just a fact. Like, to me, that's the closest comparison I can come up with about how the committee operates. So yes, transparency about the net, transparency about how to schedule, what's the best way and how does seeding go about. I think those are things that I hope that I'm going to come out of that meeting with and
The other part will be interesting to me, Debbie, is how we're progressing. I'm not of the same mindset of Coach Auriemma in terms of that the regionals, 2 regionals versus 4 is ruining our game. And, you know, I have so much respect for Coach Auriemma and what he's done and the kind of coach he is. But I would view this a little differently. But I wonder if I know this is not being in the selection show, I know it's a little bit different subject, but I think we got to know what are the data points of fan engagement, of, you know, just, you know, what, how did we do on social media engagement? How do we do in viewership? How do we do in attendance? How do we do in ticket sales? How do we do in all that? I think those are other things in the growth of our game that we need to constantly be looking at. And I know you've been a proponent of, you know, having the one regional in, you know, one regional with 16 teams. So, and I'm with you on, and I was part of the room that went to the eight. So I can't put that on anyone else. I thought it was the right next step, but I think we also have to have a really good evaluation process of how's that going? What's changed in our game? How, what kinds of opportunities do we have? And I think all of those things need to be much more transparent and much more consistent with how our game is going.
I would like to learn why we have to advance the site so far out. I think we went through a time where nobody wanted us. And now I think we're in a time where everybody wants us.
Yes, and agreed.
Mm-hmm. We have moved to another level and we have to build on it. And yes, I am a big proponent of one. This would be year 15, talking about the Sweet 16 to Vegas, you know, when nothing was happening in Vegas and no sports teams, no franchises, nothing was in Vegas. We weren't even allowed to host NCAA championships in Vegas when I started talking about it. So
yeah,
I do think
how things have changed.
Yeah, you're right about the data, the metrics, what do we measure? And how can we capitalize? Like, I want to know why we can't find multi-million dollar sponsor to slap a logo on everybody's jersey for the NCAA women's tournament.
Totally agree.
I think
the sponsorship deal that's in place right now, and that this I do know about, the NCAA for the men never intended to be this way. The corporate sponsorship, the corporate champions program for the NCAA tournament for the men is never intended to disadvantage the women, for sure.
No, but it was not.
There is another tier that needs to be opened up for the women, and it needs to be reevaluated because it is affecting the growth of the women's tournament, and specifically in regard to corporate sponsorship. What you just said, the reason we can't have that is because of the structure of the men's champions program. Yeah.
So you're right. The corporate champions program has carried all the NCAA championships, but really was put in place for the men's Final Four. And so you're right. This is 15 years ago. I was trying to carve out some autonomy for us to be able to try on our own. Like, what could we do? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, things have changed drastically with what happened in San Antonio and then, you know, all the reports and the money and the investment. And we're still just a small amount we have so much growth and our product is so good. I say the product is the narrative all the time. It is a thing I say. I have shirts printed that say the product is the narrative. I have my, you know, I do because I hope people are going to ask me, what does that mean? And I'm like, come on, like get on board. You know, like this is going to be really fun.
But I also think the storytelling, I never want the storytelling to become more important than the product. But I do think that
with the
growth, it needs to come congruently. And they need to know these the stories of these players at the same time as they're appreciating how far the product has come. And I do think that's really important. So, you know, there's still like 20 documentaries on a men's sport and there's, you know, one on a women's sport and just, you know, just all those different things are just so important. So, and now with the new streaming platforms with Peacock and Tubi and, you know, Fox and all the different things of people that can have options to do that. And I know the media industry is just a, you know what, storm right now. But still, I do think if we really want to maximize our growth, we have to strategize about storytelling as much as we need to also remember that the product is incredible.
So I do agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. I am one that is someone that protects the game. To me, the strategies, the game always comes first. The storytelling in game is second, but that doesn't change the storytelling around the game and other platforms. I've even said, and since we're just spitballing here, right, and throwing stuff out, and I'm sure there's going to be people that are going to be watching and listening and that are going to go Antonelli and Close. Do not put them in the same room together. I want to ask the NCAA to give $1 million back to ESPN. We have the best storytellers. We have the product, the infrastructure. we have the mechanisms to be able to tell the stories. And if we would take some of that money and just use it to do what you're saying, I think it would build our product even better. I think it would put our product in other spaces. And I mean, I want the money to go to ESPN. I work for ESPN. Okay. But
wise woman.
The money could go to other places too, if they would be willing to share, right? And that if people would work together, I just think that there are opportunities there. And to me, there's no better storytellers in our game than what we have on our roster at ESPN. And we do have the infrastructure to do it. We have the platform to distribute it. We have a lot of things that could work. So,
just like you're
$1 million, Corey.
Hey, I could see that. I think that just like you're wise to speak to the opportunities of ESPN, and ESPN has been so instrumental in growing our game. That's just undeniable. And the increase of coverage in just a short period of time, that there's no wraparound coverage in the NCAA tournament anymore. Now ABC is covering so many more games. Right. I mean, there's been just tremendous growth. And I do agree that I didn't think we renegotiated that contract a couple of years ago very well, not very strategically, because if you were thinking that way and how sports were going, you would have worked that storytelling into that contract at that point in time. And that being said, though, that's ESPN is only responsible for the NCAA tournament and then, contracts especially with the SEC. The reality is also, it's a both and, it's not an either or. That, the Foxes, the CBSs, the NBCs, the Peacocks that are covering the Big Ten, for instance, like that's an important piece of this,
Sure.
And I believe that I sort of went on a rant a couple weeks ago, after our Ohio State game about media. But I think it's a two-way street. I actually got some media members that reached out to me after that and said, well, there's some coaches that don't let us in our And there are shootarounds, or yep. there's some coaches who won't even give us time to talk about the game beforehand. Shame on us. Shame on us that we would not do that. Because if we're going to demand more exposure and demand that people show up and tell our stories, then we need to meet them and allow them the access to do so. And if they don't have the professionalism to handle it well, then never let them in again. But until they don't handle it well, we need to err on the side of exposure and access so that people can do their jobs.
I'm glad you brought up your rant. I thought it was an important rant. I was going to ask you about it anyway. Is there anything else about your rant that you want to clarify, talk about, advance?
Well, I do think one thing I didn't get a chance to say is that there were people that were there at the, there were two writers, I think, that were a couple writers that were at the Ohio State game. They just didn't ask to talk to us. So there was no media, no one that was talking to any of our players about their game or getting, and I don't care about me, but their comments on what we saw the game happening. And I know it's bowl season or whatever else, but I just thought we were past that. But the one thing I didn't get to clarify is a lot of people have said, well, that's just traditional media. They're absolutely in a tough spot because of all the different things that are going on. I said, well, then what about non-traditional media? What about, there have been some specific blogs, podcasts, different things of people that have a real interest in growing our game. Then get out of the traditional media lanes and allow some other people to tell the stories. And so if we don't have enough coverage, then we're going to have to expand our comfort zone. The landscape has changed. It's not just the networks now. As much as I appreciate the networks, it's nothing against them, but if they can't cover all of the things that are going on, we shouldn't be bumped down. Then we need to find other people that are willing to elevate us up.
Very quickly, I'm going to share this with you because I've never said this publicly anywhere, so I'm going to say it one time here. When the WNBA All-Star Game was in Indianapolis, I've worked for the Fever in 20 years. I've worked for the Fever. I applied for a credential for the All-Star Game through the processes of the WNBA and got denied. So I asked, how can I, I've been covering the league from its inception, and I think I might be the only person in broadcast television from the very beginning, because I did the ABL before that. And so it was kind of like, why am I being denied? And they said I needed a producer to validate my application. So I went through the processes. I kept my mouth shut. I didn't say a word. I didn't make a big deal about it. I ended up getting a credential because the Fever credentialed me for the game. And then later on, right before the All-Star game, a podcaster with 1,400 followers was posting and bragging about getting credentialed for the WNBA All-Star game. And I just went, I'm not going to say anything. At some point, I'll be able to say something. It'll come back. This seems like the perfect time to say it, right, since we brought it up. But you're right. There's a balance between the broadcast platform and that medium, which is necessary for our game because we have the ability to reach the most people. But there is a growing segment of social media that you cannot ignore from what you just said. We're doing a podcast, bloggers, social media influencers, all those people that are out there in our landscape right now. But you also need to understand who the demographic is of who's watching on what platforms. Agreed. Who's watching the women's game? All right. So any comment on that?
No, I just think you're absolutely right. I think we need to broaden our lens a little bit and do the work to understand our audiences. But, I think about the great example of this is that Dancing with the Stars this year did better than it's ever done in its voting, like blew it out of the water. And half the people I didn't know. I knew Jordan Chiles because she's a gymnast, sure. From UCLA. and I knew Baron Davis, but I didn't know the others. But what it did is it showed me that times have changed. Our players started telling me about, well, this person's a YouTuber from here, and this person is this one from here. Yeah. And they totally shifted their audience. Our players never watched Dancing with the Stars. But credit to them, they were like, we have to reach this younger audience. We're trying to reach this younger audience. How do we do that? And they invited people from this landscape that someone old like me never even heard of. And they got better numbers than they had ever gotten in the past. Well, it's the people that are going to look at our landscape and go, man, there's incredible momentum here. What is it going to look like to truly pour gasoline on the fire? And that's going to take, innovation. That's going to take understanding how things have changed. That's going to be pushing comfort zones. But I do think that was a great example to me. Like, wow, if you don't change, you die. And credit to them that they figured out a way to change to maximize garnering a whole new demographic. And then they blew it out of the water. Or look at the Savannah Bananas, right? You look at
They're awesome.
Incredible. And I actually follow him in his leadership. And I'm like, man, women's basketball could learn a lot from this guy. Like, he understands his fan base and he understands like what the purpose is, what's their fueling and how it influences decision making and the sacrifices that need to get made and the connections. And I just think he's incredible. And so I just think we could learn a lot from some of these trends that are happening and what's capturing audiences so that we can continue to put gasoline on the women's basketball flame.
I love that. I'm going to start following him myself. That Savannah Banana president is his logo's all over the place in the summer. I see it everywhere I go.
It's awesome.
Okay. So I want to go back to something you brought up before about coaches, practice, shoot arounds, etc. I'm not going to call anybody out. I've been doing this for 38 years. I have learned that, and I am starting to believe this more, shoot around is not for me. I'm prepped. I'm ready. I've watched film. I read the game notes. I've looked at everything I need to look at. I'm going to shoot around so I can listen to your narrative. I want to hear your voice, what you emphasize, what's important to you. What are the first three things you do? What are the emphasis for the game? And then let me build out the story from there with my own game plan. I take your voice. I take the other coach's voice. I listen. I watch. I learn. And then I can advance the game to a higher level. That's what I think. So I'm not there for me. I'm really there for you. So if you don't want me there, okay, that's fine. That's on you. But if you don't want me there, then there is no way in any shape or form that I can build a relationship, build trust, and help advance our game. Yep. Your voice is so much smarter, and what you do, I'm never smarter than any coach. I want to learn. I want to listen. So if you go in there with an attitude that you think you know it all, you're not going to learn anything.
Right.
When I say that, because I know you give full access. I mean, I've been in your locker room. I've seen what you've written on the board. I've never, like, betraying a confidence in that area would never allow me to do this for 38 years.
Absolutely.
I'm just thinking for myself.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about the whole access piece to what you're doing?
Well, and it's so interesting because, you know, Mick Cronin on our men's side, which I have a great relationship with him, and he's an excellent coach. His work speaks for itself. But he came out just yesterday talking about, like, I don't understand these coaches that give so much from their practices. And, you know, you don't see Belichick or you don't see some of these other people giving things. Like, that's just ridiculous. Why would you give up any strategy? And I think it's just a difference of philosophy. You know, I see it differently, that I don't care if you know what, you know, within reason. But the reality is, I trust the professionalism of the media. And if they don't, you know, then I'm not going to trust you again. And so what you said is, you know, there's just so much on the line. But my thing is, what's on the line if you don't give them access? Less exposure, less storytelling. And one of the things I've appreciated, and you've done this several times with me, but just, you know, the last couple of games, the commentators have either asked me on the the prep Zoom or at our shoot around, hey, what's the story that nobody's telling that you want told? What's the insight to anything that's happening with your team that you want the megaphone, you know, put on? And I just appreciated that, you know? And so, like, we're all in this together, in my opinion. And if the bottom line, as long as they're not given, like, hey, this is exactly how we're going to attack actions, like, give me a break. It's not about us and what's written on a board. It's about the players going and executing and, you know, doing it from that perspective. So I just think it's incredibly short-sighted. If we want our broadcasts to be great, and because coaches will also sometimes be the first to criticize the broadcasters for how they did the game. Well, I'm like, well, did you give them access to the right preparation? Did you give them the right stories to tell?
Yeah.
You know, so I just think it's a two-way street. And I think we always need to be working on what's best for the game and building trust with each other and not do anything out of fear. To me, that's never a good way to make a decision.
There is a trust factor there. I'm going to give you a good example. I had a men's game player that is supposed to be a superstar is in a slump. Okay. Before the game, the coach says, you know, I said, what are you going to do to get him going? We're going to script the first two plays for him. We want him to score. Okay. The first time down the floor, some other guy jacks it up. The second time down the floor, he jacks it up without a pass, dribbles into a three. Coach subs him, rips him. Okay. If you didn't know, if like I was able to, it lessens the blow on the coach who's 100% frustrated, who I 100% agreed with on, he ran two sets for you and you did not take advantage of them. And he's trying to get you going for the team, not just for you. And so that's the kind of stuff that.
Yep. It's a great example.
It's a good example of, I have a relationship. I have a level of trust. I know the first time I breach it, if I ever breach it, that's it. I'll never get the access again. Why would I want to do that? I have had coaches ask me, is so-and-so playing after I just watched their shoot around? And I'm like, now, you know, I'm not going to tell you that. Mm-hmm. You know, how dare you even ask me?
Yeah. Yeah.
After all this time. Mm-hmm. But I do think the relationship piece of it does matter. It matters with the officials. Same with us. Hey, there's officials that don't want to talk to me anymore. They won't even look at me when they come out to the game because I have either questioned their call and they took it personal.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is interesting to me. Like, I'm a big believer that responsibility without authority is debilitating. And I have a responsibility to grow our game. I have a responsibility to, you know, make sure that we continue to have the right things rewarded in our game. But, you know, one of the things I don't have authority on is how the game is called. And I have accountability. If I lose, if I coach a crappy game, I still got to go and be in front of the media. I got to do that. I mean, bottom line is I have to take responsibility for my actions. I think our officials are really good people. They work really hard. There's no doubt about it. But our system is broken, in my opinion, on that. Mm-hmm. And I think there has to be a a revamping of how the whole accountability structure of officiating goes, how they're placed, the communication, the authenticity of what's shared, all of those things. I had a really interesting moment. My agent, who a few years ago, he had very few female women's basketball clients, and he mostly coaches on the men's side, his clients. And he said, man, the product of women's basketball is unbelievable. So great. The TV coverage, oh, it's soaring. It's amazing. The crowds, oh my gosh, they're getting better everywhere I go. He said, the officiating is holding it back. And I get to get most of the best officials, like, because sure. of where we are. But yep. in terms of the whole growth of the game, after that, those first couple layers, I think you have to look at it as this, what are we doing systematically that's not allowing our officiating to progress at the same rate as our game?
I agree with you
for saying that too.
No, you shouldn't get in trouble for that because you're telling the truth. I agree with you. We have great people. I have mm-hmm. been traveling around the country mostly with officials. They are on every flight, early mornings, late nights, going to the next spot, just like us. And there are really great people out there. There Absolutely. Are some of them that are really good friends of mine. But the way the system is set up, you're right, it's not really fair. We have these coordinators that work the power leagues, and they are responsible for officiating for 5 months. And then we have 3 weeks where it goes to the NCAA. And that's just not set up for success. There's just not, and it's not an indictment on any of the coordinators or Penny Davis at the NCAA. I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's got to be some sort of fixable, manageable continuity somehow that allows us to keep the best officials on the biggest games. I'm not a big fan of educating and training a young official in the NCAA tournament on a game. I don't think that's good. I don't care if they're with a veteran. It's just not fair. You can't ref UCLA in the NCAA tournament if you have not refed Lauren Betts going into the NCAA tournament. I've seen that happen before. If you haven't refed the big, you can't do it. I mean, like, there's just some things that we have great people that could solve it.
Yeah.
It's just that we got to be willing to, Caitlin Clark, Clarkonomics, disruption. Okay. Kurt Cignetti, Indiana football, major disruption in the way things are done.
Yep.
Right. We just need a disruption.
We do need a disruption on that. And I think that, the officiating is, like we said, it's not an indictment on anybody because there's so many hardworking people that do it. I think when something repeats itself over and over again, you have to look at the system, not the people that are executing the system.
Yeah.
And it goes beyond people that are coming out. There are some great ones. Like I personally believe that Brenda Pento is like the best official in the game. I always know what I'm going to get with her. That's just, there's a consistency that I know of mm-hmm. with her. But as a system, I think we just need more consistency, of accountability, more authenticity about how you are. Some of the times I'll send in my clips and when I get the responses back, I'm just like, wow, we are so far off of how we view the game. I was really struck when I was in the Pac-12, we would always have the observers' ratings of the officials, and then we would have the coaches' ratings of the officials, and they were so far apart.
Wow.
And I'm just thought to myself, and every year we would talk about it, and every year we would leave frustrated. And I was just like, there's got to be a way. It can't be the coaches are right and the observers are wrong, but it also can't be the other way around. There's got to be something in the middle there that blends how all these good, well-intended people see the game. Mm-hmm. And we're just not there yet.
Well, Corey, it's thanks to coaches like you that do think about solutions, not just complain about problems, look for opportunities instead of obstacles. And we got to just keep doing it. We love it too much just to let it just happen. Perspective and priority and having a historical perspective of our game is also important as the new people come into our game. Mm-hmm. But I want to thank you for your candor, your openness, your hustle to get on with us for nothing but net. And look, next time you come on here, we got to break down some film. I got to get into the film room with you.
I would absolutely love that. So we got to do it again because I really would enjoy that. And just appreciate what you're doing. You've been a friend for a really long time, but more importantly, you've been such a pioneer for the game. And so just means a lot to partner with you in that. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Corey. You're the best. And I wish you luck. And keep rolling right through the Big Ten. You're just rolling right through.
That's one game at a time. You know how that goes. Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much for being with us on Nothing But Net. Corey Close, the head coach at UCLA.